So as the federal election now nears its end, here we are on the eve of the election, I'm pretty sure that there probably isn't anyone here who's really going to be disappointed, right, when the bombardment of advertisements disappears, you know, the election ads. So anyone here really going to be disappointed that there are going to be no more, right? I mean, you know, with the constant news coverage, too, that we have now, right, it's like a constant or never-ending stream of messaging that we receive. I mean, we have candidates giving speeches, and then we have candidates responding to other candidates' speeches, and we have political pundits analyzing and dissecting and evaluate everything that's being said. And there's visions being cast of what the country's supposed to look like. And all of this stuff, you know, it's all meant to do one thing. And it's all meant to motivate us to vote and choose one candidate over another. And you know, it's not just how candidates, right, speak for themselves that can be influential. It's how candidates seek to portray their opponents, for example. I mean, it's one of the things I find fascinating about politics and election campaigns is how candidates, well, always seek to put words in their opponents' mouths, right? I guess it means that there's less of a chance of people focusing on what words are coming out of their mouth. I don't know. But, you know, there's always a chance that things will get misrepresented and people will play fast and loose with the truth. And with so much information and so much misinformation, one thing I know for certain is that it doesn't take long for confusion to set in. Now, I'm not here this morning to tell you who to vote for. Just so you know. But as a Christian, if there's one thing I believe we should value as we weigh our options, is that we should be seeking that which is true. And the truth, I know, especially when it comes to politics, can be difficult to discern. You know, there's an old saying, and you've likely heard it, right, that the first casualty of war is the truth, right? And you see, political campaigns, it's a type of warfare. And truth can be hard to find, and we as Canadians who have this responsibility to vote and elect a government, we have our work cut out for us when it comes to discerning that which is true. I mean, so many voices, so many different visions being brought forward, it can seem like an act of futility. You know, I read a newspaper article this past week, and a poll has revealed that a lot of Canadians feel as if the political parties and the candidates just aren't speaking their language. Right? There's a great deal of confusion. I mean, there's so much confusion that there are now actually apps that can help people figure out who to vote for. You can actually download an app, or you can go online, right? And you can type in a few things, and that program will tell you who to vote for. Well, I tried one out for fun this past week. But the results, you know, they had me really concerned. And given that I had already voted in an advanced poll, according to the app, I voted for the wrong candidate. Which, of course, you know, in the end, what I ended up realizing at the app just adds to the confusion. And I wonder, you know, well, who wrote the program? And I wonder who they're voting for. You know, and I haven't even heard of them or their vision or know them, yet somehow they are able to have that much influence over how I can vote or how I should vote. You know, I don't really believe that apps like that will help me to discover the truth. But you see, I believe that people will use those apps because they are confused, right? They have difficulty discerning that which is true. And so they've decided perhaps, well, I'm just not going to worry about truth, and I'm just happy to have something that's going to make the decision for me. Right? Why remain in a state of confusion about who to vote for when there's an app for that? Because we humans, right, we don't like confusion. Never have, never will. Right? We crave peace of mind. And we really don't want to have to think about things if we don't have to. So perhaps it's appropriate, I've started thinking about this, right, that perhaps it's appropriate that in the midst of what is really a confusing time for a lot of people, that we find ourselves listening to these opening verses from the book of Revelation. I mean, Revelation, you know, it's the last book in the Bible. And one would think, you know, that as the last book, it would serve as some sort of neat and tidy conclusion to the Bible. Right? That it would be a nice, neat, tidy summation of all that had gone on before. And, you know, help clear up some things for us, you know, get rid of all the confusion and tell us which God it is we should believe in. Except the Bible doesn't work like that. Because the Bible is not an ordinary book. And the book of Revelation, it's a book that's filled with a lot of its own visions. And if one is not careful, reading it can lead to all sorts of confusion and misunderstanding. In fact, John Calvin, the great Swiss reformer, lived 500 years ago, but really was considered one of the fathers of the Reformation. I mean, our United Church tradition, a part of it, descends from John Calvin and his writings. And Calvin wrote a commentary on every book in the Bible except the book of Revelation. And why? Calvin said that he just didn't get it. He didn't understand it. He said that it created even more ambiguity. So take heart. If you have ever sat down to read the book of Revelation, you are in good company. And I believe that one of the reasons Revelation is so difficult and why we can scratch our heads when we read it is because it is full of all of this bizarre imagery. And so much so that we can fail to hear the word of God in the text. We get so caught up in the images and all that, we fail to hear what God is saying. You know, just in the first chapter alone, and I'm going to read these words. They come just after what Linda had read for us this morning. But it's a description of Jesus. So listen to these words. I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe, with a golden sash across his chest. His head and his hair were as white as wool, as white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined as in a furnace. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. And from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. So can you picture that? And so tell me, would that be the first image of Jesus to pop into your head when you think of Jesus? You see, it's easy to appreciate why so many have found this book confusing. I mean, in fact, there have been many church leaders and many Christians who have used this book and those images to distort the person and message of Jesus Christ, ones who take advantage of the confusion of people who are earnestly seeking spiritually, you know, ones who perhaps want to enforce their own psychological image onto who Jesus really is. It's a dangerous thing to do, but people do it for whatever reason. Sometimes I think it's they just want to emphasize their own self-importance, right? Impose their will on others. I mean, for example, back in the early 2000s, right up into this decade, there was a church in Seattle that became wildly popular. Everyone was pointing to it as a model for success. And why was it considered successful? You know why? Because thousands of people began attending it, right? It was led by this pastor. He was very charismatic. But more interesting is that he put the book of Revelation as his central source of learning about the character and actions of Jesus. And so through selective reading, the pastor of that mega church proclaimed Jesus, and I quote, as being a prize fighter with a tattoo on his leg brandishing a sword. Right? That was his image of Jesus, and it was the one he proclaimed over and over again. And he said that this was the Jesus he wanted to follow because this Jesus was okay with justified violence and authorized killing. And obviously, a lot of people agreed with him because they were flocking to his church. He said he wasn't interested in a Jesus, and I quote, who was a pansy or a pacifist. Right? He didn't see Christians who were devoted to nonviolent love as a source of strength or courage. But people ate up what he was saying. Right? The church board and the church leadership, they were okay with it because of the church's numerical success. But then, as you can imagine, if that's the kind of God you believe in, it will certainly affect your behavior. Well, things started to fall apart. The pastor was becoming verbally abusive towards others, insulting towards them, to the point that the church began to fail, and he was eventually dismissed. To me, that story is always a good reminder that if something is not of God, it will not last. And certainly his betrayal of Jesus, the one that he manipulated from the scriptures, did not last because it was not true. He was not seeking to hear God's voice in the scriptures and to seek that true image of Christ in the people around him. Right? He had given up on the importance of the truth for its own sake. Right? And said what was more important was him. And he was seeking to lead people on a path of easy answers and just created within them more confusion in the end. You see, as we seek to be followers of Jesus and live in the world, we need to be mindful of that danger of wanting just easy answers, because sometimes those answers will just add to the confusion that already exists within our lives and in the world around us. You know, we have to be careful and we really have to wrestle with the truth. I mean, think Jesus in Matthew, he said this. He said, I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. But you know, we are called to seek the deeper meaning of those words to really discern what is true. Right? Jesus wasn't speaking about actual physical violence and warfare. He was talking about spiritual battle, that wrestling that goes on in our lives to know the truth. Right? Jesus knew that seeking truth was something that we would always need to fight for, and it's not going to be easy. You see, sometimes people understand peace as being that absence of confusion, right? You know, they say ignorance is bliss, right? And maybe that peace of mind, like what that app promised, right? The app that was going to tell me how to vote. Right, the kind of peace that means you don't have to think about it anymore. You don't have to wrestle with the truth. Here it is for you on a platter. People will spend big money for that. Something very appealing about that. But you know, every day, because there are so many voices and visions that bombard our lives, truth is something that we are just going to have to wrestle with, and we really have to fight for it constantly. I mean, it's why in the Gospel of John, Jesus, for example, he says to his disciples that he gives them the peace that passes all understanding. Why is it a peace that passes understanding? Because it's the peace of his presence that comes in the midst of so much confusion and injustice in the world. Right? There is a truth that is meant to give our minds and our souls rest, in a way that we can therefore be freed to seek that which is true. And this is what John of Patmos, this man all those years ago who wrote down his revelation while a prisoner in exile in Patmos, right? This is what he wants his readers to remember. Right? John was a man who was well aware of the spiritual battle that was taking place or that was about to take place. And it was a battle that had left him as a political prisoner, by ones who perhaps really didn't care about the truth of Jesus or didn't want to listen to John, instead wanted to shut him up right on that island, throw him in prison, because he was seen as a threat to the peace of Rome. Right? Rome, the Roman Empire prized itself on this peace that it was able to generate, but it was that kind of peace that they brought about by the sword. There's something, you know, called that Pax Romana, the great peace of Rome. And Rome did that by the actual, you know, literally the sword. Right? And being a threat to the politics of Rome meant you could end up in exile like John, or you could end up on a cross like Jesus did. I mean, John knew that Christians in the early church could very easily just give up seeking the truth and just go with the flow. I mean, it's very tempting. It's easy to trade the struggle with the truth for easy answers, for a kind of like worldly peace that really resembles more something along the lines of apathy. Right? John addresses his vision to seven churches. That's why you have the seven lampstands and that kind of imagery, right? Because there are seven major urban centers that he's seeking to address this message to. Back then, that really wasn't, Rome wasn't the heart of the Roman Empire then, although the people in Rome would have told you otherwise, but really, the center of Rome was in Asia Minor. It was in what is now modern-day Turkey back then. And so there's all of these visions that fill this letter of John to these seven churches at that time. And what John wants to make clear to them from the beginning is that this revelation, this is actually the word of Christ. And what is to be heard first and foremost is the word coming from God. And this is where truth would be found. Right? He refers to Jesus as the Alpha and the Omega. Alpha being the first word of the Greek alphabet, Omega being the last. You know, it's one of the ways John understands that Jesus is the source of all things, of the truth, the one who holds things from the beginning to the end, right? And that's actually quite a thought, because back then, Rome was the Alpha and the Omega, right? But it's not the emperor. It's not a country. And it's not an app either. Right? And John, you see, by making this known as an example of one man alone who was wrestling with the truth in his life, and not the sake of his own self or for the sake of his own self-importance, but because of what it can mean to others. Right? And he says to his listeners, he writes it there at the beginning, he says, grace to you and peace. Right? That grace and peace that he must have had in his own heart to sit down on that island in that exile to write this down. Right? And it was the kind of grace and the kind of peace he knew his listeners would need, and that any one of us needs when things get confusing. Especially if you want to rise above that confusion. And you know, someone who I believe in our world right now, who is a wonderful example of that, you know, who carries that grace and that peace that rises above confusion, is Abiy Ahmed. Have you heard of Abiy Ahmed? Abiy Ahmed, he was recently named the 2019 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. And if you listen to Ahmed's story, it's really to appreciate the life and the journey of a man who was wrestled with the truth of Jesus, and really has sought to bring that truth into the lives of others, especially in the midst of great confusion. You see, Ahmed is the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, and at age 43, he's the youngest leader on the African continent. And he, growing up in Ethiopia, you know, we all hear the news, right, from far away. We all know Ethiopia has had its fair share of troubles. And he grew up in the midst of that, surrounded by politics and war and power struggles. You know, talk about voices and visions, they were all around him. And not just, you know, politically in the larger scope, but at home. His father was a Muslim, and his mother was a Coptic Orthodox Christian. Right? And then, you know, just before Ahmed became prime minister, Ethiopia had been at war with neighboring Eritrea for 2 years. 80,000 people had been killed. Previous governments in the country had been considered corrupt. They ruled out of a sense of self-importance. You know, opposition had been outlawed. The country's prisons were filled with political prisoners. And to top it all off, when he became prime minister, Ethiopia was in a declared state of emergency. Sounds like a confusing situation, doesn't it? A little or a lot? And so when Ahmed was elected prime minister, this is what he did. And this is where you see the grace and the peace at work and the belief in a deeper kind of truth. Because he did rise above the confusion. I mean, and Ahmed, just to say, he's neither a Muslim like his father, nor is he Orthodox like his mother. He's a Pente, they call them, in Africa, an evangelical Christian. And his faith is really seen as a driving factor in his push for peace. Outside observers, journalists from the BBC and other places have noted that he has this capacity to offer a vision that comes from belief in a deeper truth. Right? And he speaks a language that many in his country long to hear. But you see, there's been so much violence and confusion for so long, they lost their ability to hear it. Ahmed, this is what he did in his first 100 days as prime minister. This is why he won the Nobel Peace Prize. So think of this, 100 days. He lifted the country's state of emergency. He granted amnesty to thousands of political prisoners. He discontinued media censorship. He legalized outlawed opposition groups. He dismissed military and civilian leaders who were suspected of corruption. And he significantly increased the influence of women in Ethiopian political and community life. Wow. In 100 days as a leader of a country. Right? A lot on the line. But he did it. And by the way, he also did this, which probably is even harder. There had been a schism in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church 25 years ago. He got the two sides together, and they were reunified. And I'll tell you, splits in churches are a lot harder to rectify than splits in countries sometimes. But you see, as a man of faith, Ahmed's actions and words and the vision he casts, the vision to this day, it's rooted in the truth of what love can do, right? Which is the truth that Jesus always proclaims. Ahmed said this. He said, you know, we live in a country that is endowed with great bounty and wealth, but is starving for love. And I think that can be said about a lot of countries in our world. Because a lot of people, when they get caught up in the confusion, they really don't want to wrestle about that love, with that love, or the truth of that love. Because you see, for the way of love, you know, especially the cross of Christ, as the cross of Christ reveals that love, right? That love is never an easy truth. Because love takes work. It does. It's not an easy answer. And as the cross of Christ that tried to display and displayed that kind of love reminds us, it will always be surrounded by confusion. But it remains the way through which peace and grace can prevail, and the way that life will go on. Thanks be to God. Amen.